We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with local and state Medicaid.
Yeah, state Medicaid's announced this week that they will stop paying for emergency room visits that they deem unnecessary for Medicaid recipients. Now, this would be taking the decision out of the hands of doctors as to whether or not a patient needs treatment in the ER room. And this is way worse than their original proposal to save money in Medicaid by limiting ER visits to 3 times a year. Now, there would be no exceptions to this rule. Not for kids, not for nursing home patients, not for someone brought in by an ambulance, not even for people brought in with neurological symptoms or unstable vital signs. If you come in, say, for example, and your blood pressure is plummeted and you have chest pain, if you go to the ER and they run tests on you and determine that you're really okay, maybe you were dehydrated or something, then Medicaid won't pay for it. Even though when a doctor sees you and hears those symptoms, he's not going to know. He can't look at you and see it, look into a crystal ball and say, you're going to be fine or you're going to die unless I treat you. That's crazy. And what that does is it puts doctors and hospitals into an impossible position. They can't refuse treatment for someone with serious symptoms, or they get into legal trouble. They get into malpractice issues. They have to treat that person. And if Medicaid refuses to pay, they're not going to be allowed to bill that person for the services. Hospitals will have to eat that. And what really bothers me about all this, in addition to the fact that this is putting Medicaid patients in jeopardy, and it's also putting an unfair burden on doctors and hospitals to be the gatekeeper for Medicaid. What really bothers me is that there is an easy solution to this problem of ever increasing Medicaid expenses. Now, the state has about 1.2 million Medicaid recipients. Of those 1.2 million people, there are about 4,000 of them who are frequent visitors to emergency rooms. And a lot of those people, it's because of pain management issues. Now, there's a real simple way to deal with this. It's if the state were to hire a group of social workers to follow up with those people, make a list of those people who are frequent visitors of the ER, set up a case management system where you have social workers follow up with those people and make sure that they're going to see a primary care doctor on a regular basis, that they're getting their prescriptions filled, that they're getting their Medicaid reimbursements on time, et cetera, et cetera. Making sure that those people make small lifestyle changes that help them stay out of the emergency room. That's been proven to work in other places. I believe in Boston, they instituted a case management system that helped save the state quite a bit of money on frequent emergency room visits.
Yeah, if you think about it, a couple, 3 hours worth of a case manager's time is way less expensive than even one.
Than a $20,000 emergency room visit.
Yeah,
definitely. So the state really needs to look at that and really needs to get serious about something like that instead of making doctors have to decide whether or not to provide services to patients who are reporting serious symptoms.
All right. Moving on, state insurers reserves.
Yeah, this week, State Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler announced what he understands to be excess cash stockpiled by the three big nonprofit insurers in the state of Washington. He says that the three biggest nonprofit insurers are sitting on about $2.4 billion.
Who are those insurers?
Well, those insurers are Premera Blue Cross, Regents Blue Shield, and Group Health Cooperative. And of that $2.4 billion, he insists that at least $1 billion of that is excess cash. It's not real reserves. Now, reserves is a technical term that refers to money, to cash held by the insurance companies in order to pay out on claims and to pay other unanticipated expenses. Kreidler insists that only about half of that stockpiled cash is for reserves. Well, the nonprofits came back this week and said, well, it's not just cash to pay out claims. We have to set aside a certain amount of reserves for when health care reform kicks in 2014, and everybody in the state of Washington will have to have insurance, including people who are chronically ill. But, of course, this doesn't take into account the fact that a lot of people who don't have insurance now, a lot of very young and very healthy people, will also be required to pay insurance premiums and purchase insurance, too. So I'm with Kreidler on this. I think these big nonprofits, instead of having jacked up insurance rates by I believe it's doubling insurance premiums for their patients in the past 6 years, I think they should return some of that money to their customers in the form of lowering their premiums in the next year or two.
Yeah, and bear in mind also that when health reform kicks in, it has insurance coverage requirements, but it does not have cost control requirements.
Yeah.
So expect that those rates will continue to go up under health care reform, even though they have these massive reserves.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, sports arenas, new sports arenas.
Yeah, it turns out that Mayor Mike McGinn and the city council have been quietly negotiating for a return of the National Basketball Association or a new team for the National Hockey League with a sports arena to replace Key Arena. Now, of course, the Seattle Sonics moved from Seattle about, 4 years ago now after a new owner decided that Key Arena wasn't sufficiently state-of-the-art and basically negotiated in a way where he wouldn't take yes for an answer, demanding that taxpayers cough up $500 million for a new arena. At that time, in 2006, Proposition 91 was overwhelmingly passed by voters, which required that the city at least have net neutral and preferably make money on any kind of an arena deal for an arena. Now, a lot of the media coverage this week and a lot of the politicians' statements this week about a new arena are talking about how no new taxes will be required, blah, blah, blah. But what they're not talking about is that, number one, they can't put new taxes in place for a sports arena because the law, without passing a law that supersedes Proposition 91, which would be very politically unpopular to do. Proposition 91 passed with well over 70% of the vote. Beyond that, even if there are new taxes, there's going to be any number of incidental expenses for the city with overtime and whatnot.
And consultants' fees, which they've already spent quite a bit on.
Yes, they're already spending $19,500 a month for a consultant for a stadium and arena construction and to try and cut that deal. So it is costing the city money, although not nearly as much money as if it were paying up front for the arena. And the flip side of that is that the economic benefit for these arenas is generally pretty minimal. A lot of studies have shown that entertainment money that isn't spent on a new arena is usually spent on other entertainment venues instead. So the number of jobs created is actually remarkably low for the amount of money that's spent on these projects. So if they wind up cutting a deal that doesn't involve taxpayer money, that's good. Obviously people get a lot of enjoyment out of sports franchises, and that's not a bad thing. But, the whole dynamic of, taxpayers underwriting private businesses where, billionaires are paying millionaires to play a game. Seattle really has PTSD over that. It's never really recovered from having two instances in the mid-90s where stadiums were turned down by voters and then they were built with taxpayer money anyway. Hopefully this deal can be cut without taxpayer money being spent. But when you say that there are new taxes being raised for this project, don't think that means that taxpayer money is not being spent, because it is.
Yeah, and all indications so far are that taxpayer money will eventually be spent on the arena. Now, a lot of the documents that have been involved in the agreement so far haven't been filed with the city, and that's a bit of a scandal in itself because there are certain requirements that these documents be filed with the city in a timely manner and that they be available for the public to see. But a lot of these negotiations have been going on in secret. And yet the news organizations, the Seattle Times and the PI, who have requested copies of the documents that are available, have seen mentions of public-private partnerships. And we know what public-private partnership means. It means partial financing by the private sector and partial financing by the public sector. That means taxpayer money eventually will be spent.
And just, for instance, with the consultants, I understand that those are was a no-bid contract.
That was a no-bid contract.
Not only a no-bid contract, but also the city council was not informed of the contract. Yeah. It was actually signed last July, but it didn't come to light until the last few weeks.
So it reminds me of one of the jokes you've both previously made about Eat the State, and that it's the same stories coming back again and again, just the names.
We do a search and replace.
Change.
Yeah.
All right.
They'll be building a parking garage soon, too.
Yes.
All right. Well, on to probably the only item of positive news this week. The Marriage Equality Act passed this week.
Yeah. In fact, it is now awaiting Governor Gregoire's signature. That should happen very shortly. Now, unfortunately, because a right-wing group is trying to get this onto the ballot until fall, it's likely that the ability for same-sex couples to wed will not take place until it actually gets passed by voters this fall. It will not take effect immediately upon signature by Governor Gregoire, because that will be challenged almost immediately by the referendum campaign. But nonetheless, we're this one step closer. And of course, we also had a milestone ruling in California this week where Proposition 8.
Speaking of voters, weighing in on gay marriage.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, but, the court ruling on Proposition 8 does not have widespread national precedence, but it does have precedence, in states in which same-sex couples already have essentially the rights of marriage or all of the rights of marriage except for name only, which of course describes Washington State. Mm-hmm. And so the unconstitutional nature of Proposition 8 might well also be applicable to any kind of effort to take away gay rights that happens with a referendum campaign this fall. The language for the ruling for the Proposition 8 ruling stated pretty explicitly that there was no other purpose to the passage of Proposition 8.
I actually have the wording here,
and
it starts, "All that Proposition 8 accomplished was to take away from same-sex couples the right to be granted marriage licenses and thus legally to use the designation marriage. Proposition 8 serves no purpose and has no effect other than to lessen the status and human dignity of gay men and lesbians in California." And I think the key word there is in California, in terms of its applicability to Washington. But I don't think it'll be much of a stretch for people who are proponents of gay marriage here in Washington to be able to take the initiative to court and say, in California, they decided that voters weighing in on the rights of a minority is unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional in Washington as well. So I think that would be a very good argument.
And remember that the ruling in California was in federal court. It was in the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah.
And that Ninth Circuit also covers Washington State.
Yeah.
It's for the entire United States West.
Yeah. Now, a little more on the Proposition 8 ruling in California. Marriages under the ruling can't resume for another couple weeks because of a court-imposed stay, but which will expire in a couple of weeks. And, of course, the proponents of Proposition 8 in California said that they will appeal and they eventually want to take it to the Supreme Court. That's kind of a dicey question because, as we know, the Supreme Court is very conservative right now. But if the opponents of Prop 8, folks who support gay marriage, if they accumulate enough legal decisions in their favor, then maybe the Supreme Court will have no choice but to weigh in their favor.
Yeah, and particularly because legally the proponents for Proposition 8 have been placed in a very difficult situation in that there is now a track record of what happens, sociologically speaking, with gay marriage, because there are several states where it's been legal for a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're finding is there's no downsides to it. I mean, you know, gay married couples are pretty much the same as straight married couples,
yeah,
sociologically speaking. And so the only actual legal arguments that proponents of Proposition 8 have been able to muster, both in the original court proceedings and in the appeal proceedings, have basically been religious arguments. And they've been tautologies. It's wrong because it's wrong. And they're not getting anywhere with those arguments.
Yeah.
And so even taking it to the Supreme Court, it would have to be a pretty nakedly ideological and a pretty nakedly religiously based decision in order for Proposition 8 to be upheld.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, further developments regarding the Susan G. Komen Foundation.
Yeah. Last week, after the Komen Foundation went back on their ban for funding for Planned Parenthood by saying, well, we will fund organizations that are under investigation, just not the ones that are under criminal investigation, a reporter for the Huffington Post, a man named Richard J. Eskow, he decided to look at the Komen Foundation's recipients and see if there were any others that had been under investigation. And what he found is that, yes, there are several that have been or are now currently under federal investigation. And I'm just going to read you a little short list here. Harvard University is under federal investigation for discrimination against Asian Americans and for violations of the Animal Welfare Act because of their treatment of lab animals. Yale University is under federal investigation for problems with not enforcing sexual misconduct and harassment rules. Columbia University is under federal investigation for religious discrimination. The University of Texas for regarding their executive salaries and compensation packages. Massachusetts General Hospital is under investigation by the Department of Health and Human Services for patient privacy violations. The University of Madison, a cancer researcher resigned recently because of conflicts of interest, and they are also under investigation.
University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Yes. And then Penn State, of course, as you know, is under investigation because of the scandal over sexual abuse of minors by a football coach there. And, of course, but the worst federal violations that he found when looking at the Komen Foundation was had nothing to do with their recipients of funds, but the folks who helped to fund the Komen Foundation, the big corporate donors. Ford Motor Company, for example, has been under multiple federal investigations for defects in their products, in their automobiles and trucks. American Airlines, who is a major donor to the Komen Foundation, but they also turned around and then screwed their retirees out of pension payments, and they are now under investigation by the federal government. And Bank of America, who is among their elite funders of the Komen Foundation, of course, as you know, is under federal investigation for widespread and repeated mortgage fraud. So I found that very interesting. And of course, then this week, too, Karen Handel, the former Tea Party candidate for governor of Georgia, who the Komen Foundation hired as their VP of public policy, she resigned this week because the Komen Foundation went back on their pledge to cut funding for Planned Parenthood, which tells you a little bit about who was really responsible for this.
Yes, she'll have a gig on Fox News soon.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the singer Pink, out of disgust, decided to change her name this week.
Don't we wish?
All right. Moving on, President Obama having a press conference this week regarding their stance on contraception.
Yeah, the whole dust up this week over the Obama administration's policy regarding employers being required to fund contraception stirred up a largely media-led controversy, because this was not a controversial policy, nor was it a new policy. Most of what the Obama administration had announced a couple of weeks ago was that it had actually been in place since the Clinton Clinton administration in 2000 had not been challenged at all during the entirety of the 8 years of the Bush administration, but was rather noisily challenged over the past couple of weeks during an election year by conservative Catholic bishops and their allies in conservative media. So the Obama administration came up with a quote-unquote compromise that if employers wouldn't provide for contraception, the insurance companies must provide it. Now, most media coverage has said that insurance companies and employers must supply it free of charge. That's not exactly accurate, since, of course, employees are still paying for their insurance. It just Yes. means it's one of the things that is covered under the insurance. But given that, depending on your estimate, somewhere between 98% and 99% of American women use contraception at some point during the course of their life, including a vast majority of Catholic women, you have to ask where the controversy came from during this, and who exactly appointed the Catholic hierarchy as martyrs of sexual morality or arbiters of sexual morality, given that this is the institution responsible for what may well be the largest scandal of child sexual abuse in the history of the world. So it really is kind of a fascinating case study in where these kind of manufactured controversies come from, because there really was no controversy here. It was not a policy that ordinary people were upset about.
All right. Well, moving on to a policy that people were upset about, mortgage settlements.
Yeah, this week the feds announced a $26 billion settlement with the five biggest mortgage lenders in the nation: Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial. The $26 billion settlement would mean that those banks would pay out over 3 years to about 1 million homeowners who will have their mortgage debt reduced by these lenders, and about an additional 750,000 people who lost their homes to foreclosures since September 2008. They will receive about $2,000 each. And I just have to say, whoopee. I mean, look at this for a second here. 4 million people have lost their homes since 2008, and less than a quarter of them get a tiny little settlement payment of $1,500 to $2,000. They lost their house.
Yeah, this is something where the $25 billion is not only a drop in the bucket for these financial institutions. I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's a drop in the bucket for
these
financial institutions.
They've already set it aside.
And not only that, but it is less than a penny per dollar of what the homeowners actually lost.
Yeah. They've already set aside the cash to pay out the settlement. They could pay it out today and not see any hit to their bottom line. It's been set aside in the last couple of years as reserves. And while they've been foreclosing on people's homes, I should say. And then, of course, the people who are underwater, the 1 million homeowners who are estimated to have their mortgage debt reduced. Again, that's a drop in the bucket of the number of people who are underwater on their mortgages. Those folks are underwater an average of about $50,000 each on the value of their homes. But they will maybe get, probably $20,000 average about $20,000 each of relief. That's not going to do very much for them.
And let's be clear about this. They are underwater, or they have lost their homes specifically because of criminal acts of fraud committed by these banks, and the banks are not being held accountable for those acts. Now, there were a number of other aspects to this mortgage settlement, some of them good, some of them not. Quite aside from the grossly inadequate monetary settlement, it doesn't absolve banks of guilt or immunize them against future civil suits. But what it does do is have, again, pretty inadequate structures against enabling people to sign or enforcing against some of the bans that it has. It bans robo-signing in the future, but doesn't treat past robo-signing as a fraud.
That's the worst part of the settlement, in my opinion, is that people lost their homes because of forged documents, and these banks are not being held accountable for the robo-signing that they did, forging documents.
And not only that, but the penalties going forward for robo-signing aren't expensive enough to be a deterrent against its continuing to happen in the future.
Yeah, and we've seen that before in past SEC settlements with banks and mortgage lenders, that these monetary settlements are not enough of a punishment, not enough a deterrent for them to keep for them, you know, to stop doing this kind of these kinds of things over and over and over again. And I also want to point too that the reason why they're only estimating about 1 million homeowners will have their debt reduced is because most homeowners are not going to qualify. They either don't have their mortgages owned by those five banks, they're owned by private investors, or they have their mortgages through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who are not part of the settlement. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac own about 50%, maybe probably a bit more now, of all U.S. mortgages. They're not covered by this settlement at all.
Yeah, or nobody has a clue who owns their mortgages.
Yeah, so in short, it's a great deal for the five banks, and it's actually going to benefit their shareholders and the executives and those banks quite a bit. It's not going to benefit homeowners or the housing market very much at all.
Yeah, the one additional thing that was done as part of this settlement, which the Obama administration does like to do quite a bit, is instituting new consumer protections. But again, those consumer protections are only valuable if they're funded and if they're enforced. And as we've already seen with Wall Street, both those things are pretty problematic.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to international and a report about regarding U.S. drone strikes.
Yeah, British Association, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, released a report this week on U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And what they found is that at least 50 of the civilians killed in U.S. drone strikes have been killed in follow-up strikes after they rushed in to rescue people from an initial drone strike. So in other words, the U.S. military and the CIA have learned a lesson from al-Qaeda that you get far more scores, far more casualties if you also target first responders and sympathetic bystanders. This report also found that that at least 20 other civilians were killed in strikes targeted at funerals, which also is a trick we learned from al-Qaeda, which liked to target people who were doing their market shopping and congregating in other public places. By targeting funerals, we can get a lot more dead. They found also that since Obama became president, U.S. drone strikes have totaled about 260 strikes. That's at least two strikes per week during the Obama administration, and that a minimum of 535 civilians were, quote unquote, credibly reported killed in total with those drone strikes, of which about 60 were children.
Yeah, and aside from killing civilians in general, targeting first responders and targeting funerals are both, by definition, considered war crimes.
War crimes, yes.
All right, well, that leaves us about 2 minutes left to talk about reactor number two.
Yes, some news coming out of Fukushima just when we were reassured by the Japanese government that all of the reactors were stable. This week they had to increase the amount of water being poured into reactor two, and they had to pour in a lot of boric acid. Well, you put boric acid into a reactor to slow down or stop a chain reaction. So essentially what they were admitting by saying, yes, we're increasing the water levels and we're increasing the boric acid, is that there's some risk of reactor number two returning to a chain reaction or criticality, which kind of puts the lie to this notion that almost a year after the earthquake and tsunami that all of the reactors are stable.
All right. Events.
Yeah, one event this week. On Monday, there'll be a rally for Seattle port truckers who are striking. Short-haul truckers have been striking the port of Seattle, striking various companies at the port of Seattle for better pay, in some cases some pay, you know, because they're not getting much pay at all, and better working conditions. That rally is going to be on Monday from 9 a.m. to noon at East Marginal Way and Hanford Street. That's under the viaduct. So come and show your support for this growing movement of short-haul truckers who are trying to strike for some better benefits. And if you can, bring donations of non-perishable food and other items for the truckers who are on strike and for their families.
Or just striking to be able to use the bathroom facilities when they're there.
When they're there, yeah.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is at www.eatthestate.org, and you also have a website, right?
Yes, I also have a website where I've been posting articles every week. It's www.mariatomchik.com. And my name, if you don't know how it's spelled, is TOMCHICK, just like it sounds.
All right. They're both just like they sound.
Except for mine.